Welcome to the IVC podcast, Veterinary Science on the Move. My name is Matthias Kleins, and today we will see that a string of letters like BVDMD means much more than what you initially see. BVDMD, the acronym stands for bovine viral diarrhea and mucosal disease, is a complex of diseases affecting the immune system of cattle which manifests in general immunosuppression. Clinically, the BVD virus causes mild gastrointestinal signs in young cattle. In pregnant animals, however, the virus can infect the fetus and cause persistent infection and immune tolerance if infection occurs in the first 4 months of pregnancy. Alternatively, it can cause abortion and fetal malformations if infection occurs later. Persistently infected and immunotolerant cattle are the cause for disease spread in herds. It is also in these cattle that BVDV, protected from the host immune response, can mutate into a cytopathic virus with the ability to cause severe disease known as mucosal disease. Today we will be talking to Professor Joel Brownlee and Dr. Dirk Werling, who are investigating how bovine cells respond to BVDV infection in order to provide information that might help the development of new diagnostic tests and treatments. Thank you, Joe, and thank you, Dirk, for joining us here today. Joe, could you give us a brief idea what BVDV actually is and where the problems in this disease actually lie?
BVD is a virus within a group that's generally called pestiviruses. And within that group, there are three major viruses. The one we're going to talk about today, bovine virus diarrhea virus. The sheep one is called border disease virus. And the swine one is classical swine fever. So that's very well known. But BVD is different. BVD is endemic. It's very widespread. 90% of the herds in this country have the virus. It was first described in the 1940s. And in those years, we've really learned to live with the virus and not considered it greatly important.
What are the clinical signs with an animal which is infected by BVDV?
In the early days, we thought it must be diarrhea, so the name is bovine diarrhea virus. But in fact, we now realise that's a very infrequent sign that we see with it. In fact, it's very badly named. It causes all sorts of problems. What we do see is a component of a number of calf diseases, calf respiratory disease and calf enteritis. And why that is because we now know it's highly immunosuppressive. And so when we get BVD and we get other viruses with it, those diseases are far worse. And experimentally, people have actually mixed BVD with respiratory syncytial virus or parainfluenza virus or IBR virus, and they're excreted at higher titer for longer periods of time, and we get more clinical disease. So BVD on its own sometimes you don't see a lot, but BVD in the field you'll see these increase in...
It aggravates other diseases.
Yes, that's right, in calf diseases. But it also has another aspect to it. It is a disease of the reproductive system. And if we get infection in early pregnancy, we get abortions. In fact, we can get abortions at any stage in pregnancy. We see the birth of calves that are either malformed or don't thrive very well. And we also get a very curious form that when they're infected in utero, they become a persistent infection. So the whole range of diseases we now recognise have been really quite important. So I think our understanding is it's no longer a mild disease that we can live with, and it's a disease that underpins a lot of ill health in the cattle industry.
How does this persistent infection in fetuses actually occur? How can the virus hide from the host's immune response so well to cause this persistent infection, which seems to be so important in what actually happens later on when BVD has an important implications?
Absolutely right, Matthias, because the PI animals are really the main reservoirs of infection. If we get rid of those persistently infected animals, we really could control BVD. And how it occurs is, I don't know anything else in nature that occurs quite like it. It's a very curious disease. If the virus gets across into the fetus in early pregnancy, in other words, the mother must get infected and she's got to be in early pregnancy, and the virus becomes systemic in the mother, goes in the bloodstream, and then it crosses the placenta into the fetus. The analogy might be rubella in women. And once it gets into the fetus in early pregnancy, it infects the fetus. Now that fetus, until the end of the first trimester, about 110, 120 days, hasn't got a fully functional immune system. At about 110, 120 days, it does become competent. And the first thing an immune system must do is recognize its own tissue, its self-tissue. And in doing that, it must destroy all the cells that do recognize it, but otherwise we get autoimmune disease. In the process of this tolerance, as we call it, central deletion tolerance, is that the viruses recognize it being self. And so all the cells that would normally recognize it as being foreign and make antibodies to it and cell-mediated immune response are knocked out. So this animal, this fetus, now goes on into its competent fetal life and actually into its competent neonatal and adult life with no immune system that can recognize it. So they become persistently infected. Nothing can stop it. And in fact, they have very high levels of virus in their blood, in their all their secretions, in their skin, and it becomes a major source of infection. The one material that's not very good is feces. And that belies the title of BVD.
So there's no great shed of virus into the feces?
Not really. Right, it seems to be inactivated. It's a very poor source. We tell practitioners and farmers, don't send us feces.
Because we won't be able to.
Because it's a very poor source. We can find it from blood and we can find it from many other samples.
Essentially, the virus comes in early enough to become part of the family. So the fetus can't detect it anymore. You've been talking about how to fight and eradicate the disease potentially already, but you have been involved in a couple of initiatives trying to improve the situation with BVD in the UK and worldwide. What are currently the strategies to control the disease globally and in the UK?
Well, I think we're quite late on the scene. In fact, the Scandinavian countries have led the way. They recognise, and we've all the people who work on BVD recognise it's an important disease. But what the Scandinavians did, and particularly their dairy industry, their actual farming industry, recognised that it is an important pathogen and that they could get rid of it. And very simply, they went about searching for these PI animals with proper biosecurity, proper screening and monitoring. In 10 years, they've got rid of BVD from the Swedish herd, the Norwegian herd, and the Finnish herd, and Denmark is following on very closely behind. From the 90s into the present decade, they've shown us that it can be done. And in fact, they did that without vaccination. Since that time, other major European countries have started to have national programs. So Switzerland and Austria, Germany. Germany's got a national program now. Other of the major European countries have got big regional programs, Italy and Spain and France. And we have eliminated from the Shetland Isles, and we're on the way in the Orkneys. We've got nothing going on here. Mm-hmm. And so we took it upon ourselves, and the Royal Veterinary College were a lead in this, to try and bring together the industry to discuss how we could do that. We've got all the major partners of the industry talking together, and we've got three pilot programs now, one in Scotland, one in Norfolk and Suffolk, and one in Somerset. Here we've taken a number of herds, we're screening them. With dairy herds it's simple because we can screen the bulk milk. With beef herds we have to screen the young stock by bleeding them. And we can look for the presence of BVD.
You have to look for the presence of virus because with the PI animals you won't be able to detect antibody titers, would you?
In fact, what we do it slightly different. We look for antibody. And if there's antibody, it'll tell us the virus must be there. Mm-hmm. So very quickly we can screen it. And if we've got antibody there, we then can go and drill down further into finding out where the PI animals are. And once we've got that, we will detect the PI and get rid of them. But also, we are using a vaccine. Because there is only a small take-up in this country at present, a little bit like Germany in a way, they are going to have an eradication program. But by finding the PIs and using a controlled vaccination program. And I think we'll do the same.
So that means the strategy will be to vaccinate the herds which actually are affected by the virus, or would it be a different approach?
Well, we'll vaccinate both, really. We'll vaccinate the herds that have got the virus to stop. In fact, the whole cycle is all to do with these very early pregnant infections. If we can protect our young animals going into the breeding cycle, then we'll stop this whole cycle. It's again like the rubella story. If we can vaccinate our girls before they become pregnant, then you'll stop the access of the virus into the unborn child or the unborn calf. And so that's what we're doing. We're using a vaccine before they go into the breeding program. And then we're also trying to reduce the level of virus in the herd by looking for the PI animal. And I'm hoping that with these three programs, we're going to get enough information of showing it's cost effective, because no farmer in the present circumstances can undertake this program unless it's going to pay him to do it. We're quite sure with the Scandinavian work that it pays in the second year, so very quickly it pays off, and we're trying to show that cost benefit, so we're doing a lot of analysis.
So I think the vaccines have been on the market for a while, haven't they? But this strategic approach of screening and vaccinating, that's new to what you're proposing now, right?
You're absolutely right. In fact, the states, they say they've got 160 different combination vaccines for BVD, and yet they had the biggest problem with BVD.
Mm.
And I think that's because people think you can just vaccinate and forget about the biosecurity and the disease itself, and it's really not good enough. So we have to use the two together. So you're right. We've had vaccines for a long period of time. They haven't made a big deal of difference. I think the proper use of vaccine, trying to identify these pea animals, will be a pathway forward for us. We can't not vaccinate because there's so much virus in with contiguous farms. Until we can get all the farms in an area pulling together, then I think to be secure, we have to vaccinate. We can't afford any breakdowns.
So is there eradication involved in this screening strategy as well, or is it only identifying the herds and using appropriate vaccination methods in these?
It's a bit of a grey line there. I'm trying to get eradication. I'm trying to get the farms to get rid of BVD and keep free of BVD.
Mm-hmm.
And then we're going to try and enroll the contiguous farms as well. But it's a big program. It's going to take us 10 to 15 years if we're doing really well to get rid of BVD or get it to a low enough level that we can have more draconian measures to get rid of the tail.
But based on the widespread effect that the disease seems to have on cattle health in general, it probably will be worthwhile in the long run.
It certainly will. And what I'm excited about, because this is a college initiative, is that the college is taking the lead on that. So the Royal Veterinary College is taking the lead in the country. We have a national strategy group, of which I'm chairman. John Fitchwick's on this program, representing the British Cattle Veterinary Association. So as a college, we're really trying to make an impact on BVD.
So, Dirk, apart from the fact that these PI animals seem to spread the disease and therefore cause a problem, they also seem to be the source of a type of virus which evolves over time. So in those PI animals, you can see mutations of the virus which then cause mucosal disease in the long run. Is that a big problem?
Well, I'm not sure whether you can say they're mutated viruses. It's more that for, I think, more or less every BVD strain, you can have two different biotypes. One is called CP, or cytopathogenic biotype, and the other one is called the NCP, or non-cytopathogenic virus. So these viruses are just differing really in what they can induce in vitro in cell types. So one is causing cell death, the other one isn't. The interesting thing is that they don't differ really in their viral genome in terms that one virus has more genes than the others. Apart from that, there's a viral protein which is differentially cleaved into two parts compared to only one part in one biotype. So what we're trying to figure out is really why this viral protein cleavage is causing such a different effect within the cells. We started doing this using microarray approaches, which has proven so far to be of limited success.
Okay.
And I'm not sure whether everyone knows what microarrays are, but in theory, a microarray is nothing else than running a PCR, a polymerase chain reaction, for specific genes. But you're not looking at one gene, you're looking at rather like 17,000 genes in one go. So you generate a vast amount of data really from one experimental setup.
So essentially what you're trying to do at the moment is, because there seems to be no real genetic difference between NCP and CP viruses, you have to see how these genes are regulated differently to actually understand what the difference between those two viruses
and,
is.
And not only what, from the viral aspect, you know, which genes are switched on or off.
Of course it affects the host cell because the virus has no
Exactly, that's what
gene
we are mainly interested in. And I think part of that goes back to what Joe already mentioned about these PI animals. What's known is that the virus somehow evades immune recognition. And the virus actually evades a very old immune system, which is called the type 1 interferon system, which is the major antiviral response element every cell type in us actually has. So the virus is not only able to avoid this, but it also is able to subsequently alter that type 1 interferon system in a way that it never will respond appropriately anymore. Now, what's been known so far is that some of the viral proteins interact with proteins involved in signaling for this type 1 interferon system, but the timely approach there isn't known yet. So that's why we came with a microarray approach to look on when are these changes starting to happen and why is only the one biotype inducing the changes and not the other one.
So do NCP and CP viruses differ in the clinical symptoms they cause in the end as well? Well, or is there not such a strong correlation as I initially believed?
Now, what's interesting, I mean, what young Dirk is describing is the white heat of technology, which is sort of, I'm the Wellington Boot side of this. And so yes. you're sort of just asking me about the clinical side. Really, the cytopathic, which sounds much more damaging than the non-cytopathic, is in fact it's the other way around. And what Dirk is trying to understand for us, why the non-cytopathic virus seems to cause much more damage in the cattle industry. Mm-hmm. It's the one that goes across, causes the PI. We never get a PI with the cytopathic virus. We can't understand that. And yet this is the major reservoir with the non-cytopathic virus. If you take those two different biotypes and you infect a calf with one or the other, the symptoms are quite similar. Where they come together as being a sort of catastrophic combination is where you get the PI calf, which of course is non-cytopathic, or they're all non-cytopathic, and then they get super infected with this cytopathic ones. They die of a fatal disease called mucosal disease. But many of them have died off before they've even got to that stage. But that is the catastrophic mix. But really what we're now understanding is that the non-cytopathic virus is really causing 90% of the damage in the BVD cycle.
So that's the one which initially causes the immune suppression, and then when cytopathic comes in, that's where we really see the problem.
The cytopathic one seems to be recognized by the immune cells quite good, actually. Mm-hmm. And from what we had so far, two sort of small-scale projects using microarrays and trying to analyze differential immune responses. And the latest data we have, which was done actually by a BSc in veterinary pathology student, Stephen Burr, showed that not only are there differences in the type 1 interferon response, meaning the CP virus is inducing type 1 interferon, which clearly indicates that the cells are recognizing the virus as foreign, whereas the NCP doesn't seem to do that. But he could also show that the NCP strain is not inducing any chemokine production within infected cells. Now, these chemokines are really quite unique because they come up very, very early infection within minutes after a cell has been infected. And they attract other immune cells to the site of infection.
Like T cells, maybe.
Like T cells or other macrophages or granulocytes. And the NCP strain seems to be able to shut down several pathways for chemokine production, as well as just down-regulating the chemokine receptor expression. So it's not only that it's able to evade, you know, the major antiviral response, but also it doesn't even give the signal to the immune system that the cell is infected, whereas the CP is inducing tons of these chemokines. So clearly showing to the body that there's an infected cell and that this infection attracts other immune cells to the site of infection. But it's still the interesting thing that these viruses don't differ in the genome. They just really differ in the cleavage of one specific protein. And what we haven't figured out yet is why this protein, or where these proteins are interfering within the cells.
So did your microarray data take you any further in the understanding of this process?
They took us further so far that these chemokine data are brand new. Mm-hmm. There's actually a very anecdotic publication from the early 1970s showing that there are differences in migration of cells infected with NCP or CP strain, but no one could at that time explain this phenomenon. Our data are the first data actually putting a proof behind this sort of anecdotal publication.
And showing the pathway.
Exactly, and showing the pathway. So if one potentially can stop the virus to interfere with this chemokine pathway, then it may be actually recognized by the host cell as something foreign, and therefore the cells will start doing something against it.
I think it's really a profound finding. I think it's so exciting. You know, in a way, 20-odd years working with BVD, and we've shown that these two different biotypes have different biological pathways, but they are genomically really quite similar, apart from this potential cleavage of the first non-structural protein. Even that although important and perhaps releases their serine protease, we never understood this whole business of the innate immune system that Dirk is describing. It would explain why the PI animal is able to become persistently infected, because it's only the non-cytopathic virus that gets in there. So I think there's some real basic science, basic virology, that Dirk and his program will pick up for BVD. So I think the next few years will show some fantastic work, particularly with the microarray.
So could you see that interfering with this cleavage process could be employed as a treatment strategy for the profound effects that BVDV infection might have?
I think it's not so much the interference with the cleavage of the protein from the viral aspect. I think it's more, if we understand what these viral proteins are doing within a host cell, mm-hmm. where they potentially interfere within the signaling, that's where we can find potentially new approaches to either stop the cell of, you know, undergoing these changes, or boost the cell in the way that, independent of the infection, they still do a specific response. The problem there is that for some of these pathways, we don't have the right tools yet. And one of the major evidences for that is Stephen actually identified a couple of genes which are 100-fold and more differentially expressed between CP and NCP infected cells. But we have no idea yet what these genes are, because the bovine genome isn't very well annotated. So we do know the sequence of the specific spot on the microarray, but by blasting that genetic information against the cattle genome, we are unable to find a gene which belongs to that. And unfortunately for us, is also if we blast that sequence against the human genome, we don't pick up any gene. So it may be that we have really cattle-specific genes we're dealing with, mm-hmm. or that specific genomic or RNA sequence we have is post-translation modified in a way that it is not recognized by the currently available programs in the human genome. So we're a bit of stuck there, really, at the moment.
Let me answer your question slightly differently. Is that I think it does have, the work that Dirk is describing does have real significance, possibly not for controlling BVD. I mean, we could control BVD. We know it can do it. It's talking farmers into it and talking the industry into taking responsibility for it. That's a different issue altogether, mm-hmm. rather pedestrian, the sort of thing I'm working with. But the sort of thing that Dirk's doing is much higher science. And where it does become so important and interesting is that the human homologue of BVD is hepatitis C. They can't grow that virus. They're fascinated by all our work on BVD. And they have a persistence with hepatitis C. Now, they are more than interested, and we've already done some work previously by making chimeric BVD and hepatitis C viruses. And so I think that all this really new data that Dirk is describing will be looked at with great interest from that point of view. So it's got a much bigger arena that market. We're working in. Yeah. than And I don't think it's to do with really control of BVD, mm-hmm. but it's to do with basic science and basic virology.
Yeah, and it's great if you can use these models and animals to drive understanding in
That's
general.
Right. Yeah.
You've mentioned the problem you had with your microarrays, that on the one hand, I think in your study, which has been published, you used a limited microarray which had mainly genes on it which were immune-related genes, and that was a human array and therefore was annotated, whilst in some of your other work you have been using with a bovine array, which is great because it covers the whole of the bovine genome, but it's not so well annotated.
Yes. The problem there is really that the first approach we took using a kind of tailored array, so it had a very limited number of genes on, it was 426 genes, which is, well, in terms of microarray systems,
small
it's
size,
nothing.
Yeah.
But the nice thing there was that most of these genes are intracellular or representing intracellular proteins. And for that, we know that around 95% of these intracellular proteins are so conserved that there's a really good chance that they're wrecked with cattle RNA as well. Now, that gave us some hints where to look at, but because it was a tailored array, it was a very limited approach. So now we took the more annotated bovine arrays where we have 17,000 genes on, but unfortunately it turned out that the genes which are interesting for us are not very well annotated. So we're coming back to the...
You're getting hits, but you can't identify
them. Yes, exactly.
You're going to be describing a new gene.
Well, that's hopefully what we're doing sooner or later.
But I guess this will be a labor-intensive task.
I think, well, actually, between Joe and me, we got several grants now where we can employ a bioinformatic person. Mm-hmm. So we can subsequently now try to figure out where these genes are located on the bovine chromosome, and then take this information and look in the corresponding human chromosome to see what genes are within this area. And that may give us some ideas. And I think the approach Joe and I am trying to follow up at the moment on the scientific side is that we're using the large arrays to give us an idea on what's going on, and then apply bioinformatic material onto that, like which pathways are up or down regulated, and then come in subsequently with the tailored arrays, the small ones, to see whether we can pinpoint a bit more where the major changes occur.
So if someone else in the college, probably related to a completely different disease, would now be interested in using arrays because there's more and more animal genomes which are more or less completely sequenced now, would you have a piece of advice which you would give those people? Because they will be facing the same problems, I guess.
Be awfully nice to Dirk, I think.
I think that's a fair reply. Yeah. Now, I think it is a tricky question. If you have no idea on what's going on, then the mouse or human arrays which are available are a quite nice tool for you to get an idea. But it is a bit of a shotgun approach, and we definitely need someone afterwards to help you analyzing the data. Because if you have, let's say, two different cell types, three different treatments, each array has 50,000 genes on, then that takes you roughly 1 to 1.5 years before you have actually analyzed all these data. Uh-huh. So if you have no idea, then unfortunately that's the way you have to go. If you have a rough idea on what you think it's going on, then try to find more tailored arrays which are more suitable for your specific question you want to answer, mm-hmm. and use these, and then you can hopefully get, you know, fitting answers. It's not the problem with the microarrays is not really in generating the data. The problem with microarrays is analyzing the data.
You create more data than you could ever have imagined creating in science within the lifespan of a scientist.
Yes.
But there's no doubt that technology in the next few years will advance so fast that the whole bioinformatics and the handling of that data will become more simpler.
Yeah.
But at the moment, it is a bit of a nightmare, really.
Big step. Yeah. But from your personal experience, you're saying that actually using human or mouse arrays can be a successful approach. So that the sequence similarity between, or the differences between mammalian genes are actually not big enough to completely rule out this approach.
No. I think as long as you, well, from our experience, I think you can say that if a protein expressed on the cell surface or gets secreted, you may struggle. As long as it's a strictly intracellular protein, then the homologies are so high that you can use microarrays from other species to answer some of these questions.
Well, aren't we 99.9% similar to a South Devon bull? I mean, aren't we rather similar?
No, well, I wouldn't say 99.9, but I think we're closer related to cattle than we are related to the mouse system, for example.
Right.
So for our cattle work, we can relate very easily to the human microarrays, and for the intracellular protein, we're talking about 92 to 95% homology. So that's really quite good. And then you can find the fitting region. So that's definitely possible.
Well, I really have to say I was really quite amazed by the insight you gave us today on this really complex issue, both of the clinical disease and how we can handle that, and also on the molecular biology of it. Thanks for joining us today, and good luck with your future work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much indeed.
That's it from us for today. Thank you for listening, and please join us again in a fortnight when we will be talking to Harriet Syme about feline renal failure. And remember, you can also subscribe to our podcast at itunes.com and make sure you won't miss a single episode in the future. In the meantime, if you have any feedback or suggestions, please send them to podcast@rvc.ac.uk. Goodbye.